the valiant part Boromir had played in all their adventures, with the wolves of the wild, in the snows under Carathras, and in the mines of Moria where Gandalf fell. Faramir was most moved by the story of the fight on the bridge. "It must have irked Boromir to run from orcs," he said, "or even from the fell thing you name, the Balrog, even though he was the last to leave."
"He was the last," said Frodo,
"but Aragorn was forced to lead us. He alone knew the way after Gandalf's fall, but had there not been us lesser folk to care for, I don't think that either he or Boromir would have fled.
Maybe it would have been better had Boromir fallen there with Mithrandir," said Faramir, "and not gone on to the fate that waited above the falls of Rauros."
"Maybe. But tell me now of your own fortunes," said Frodo, turning the matter aside once again, "for I would learn more of Minas Ithil and Osgiliath, and Minas Tirith the long-enduring. What hope have you for that city in your long war?"
"What hope have we?" said Faramir. "It is long since we had any hope. The sword of Elendil, if it returns indeed, may rekindle it, but I don't think that it will do more than put off the evil day, unless other help unlooked for also comes, from elves or men. For the enemy increases, and we decrease. We are a failing people, a springless autumn. The men of Numenor were settled far and wide on the shores and seaward regions of the great lands, but for the most part they fell into evils and follies. Many became enamoured of the darkness and the black arts. Some were given over wholly to idleness and ease, and some fought among themselves, until they were conquered in their weakness by the wild men. It's not said that evil arts were ever practised in Gondor, or that the Nameless One was ever named in honour there, and the old wisdom and beauty brought out of the West remained long in the realm of the sons of Elendil the Fair, and they linger there still. Yet even so it was Gondor that brought about its own decay, falling by degrees into dotage, and thinking that the enemy was asleep, who was only banished, not destroyed. Death was ever present, because the Numenoreans still, as they had in their old kingdom, and so lost it, hungered after endless life unchanging. Kings made tombs more splendid than houses of the living, and counted old names in the rolls of their descent dearer than the names of sons. Childless lords sat in aged halls musing on heraldry. In secret chambers withered men compounded strong elixirs, or in high cold towers asked questions of the stars, and the last king of the line of Anarion had no heir. But the stewards were wiser and more fortunate. Wiser, for they recruited the strength of our people from the sturdy folk of the sea coast, and from the hardy mountaineers of Ered Nibraeus, and they made a truce with the proud peoples of the north, who often had assailed us, men of fierce valour, but our kin from afar off, unlike the wild Easterlings or the cruel Haradrim. So it came to pass in the days of Cirion the 12th steward, and my father is the 26th, that they rode to our aid, and at the great field of Celebrant they destroyed our enemies that had seized our northern provinces. These are the Rohirrim, as we name them, masters of horses, and we ceded to them the fields of Calenarthon, that are since called Rohan, for that province had long been sparsely peopled, and they became our allies, and have ever proved true to us, aiding us at need, and guarding our northern marches and the gap of Rohan. Of our law and manners they have learned what they would, and their lords speak our speech at need. Yet for the most part they hold by the ways of their own fathers and to their own memories, and they speak among themselves their own north tongue. And we love them, tall men and fair women, valiant both alike, golden-haired, bright-eyed and strong. They remind us of the youth of men, as they were in the elder days. Indeed, it's said by our law-masters that they have from old this affinity with us, that they are come from those same three houses of men as were the Numenoreans in their beginning, not from Hador the Golden-Haired, the Elf-Friend, maybe, yet from such of his sons and people as went not over sea into the west,
refusing the call. "For so we reckon men in our lore, calling them the High, or Men of the West, which were Numenoreans, and the Middle Peoples, Men of the Twilight, such as are the Rohirrim of their kin, that dwell still far in the north, and the Wild, the Men of Darkness. Yet now, if the Rohirrim are grown in some ways more like to us, enhanced in arts and gentleness, we too have become more like to them, and can scarce claim any longer the title High. We are become middlemen of the twilight, but with memory of other things. For as the Rohirrim do, we now love war and valour as things good in themselves, both a sport and an end. And though we still hold that a warrior should have more skills and knowledge than only the craft of weapons and slaying, we esteem a warrior, nonetheless, above men of other crafts. Such is the need of our days. So even was my brother, Boromir, a man of prowess, and for that he was accounted the best man in Gondor. And very valiant indeed he was. No heir of Minas Tirith has for long years been so hardy in toil, so onward into battle, or blown a mightier note on the great horn." Faramir sighed and fell silent for a while. "You don't say much in all your tales about the elves, sir," said Sam, suddenly plucking up courage. He'd noted that Faramir seemed to refer to elves with reverence, and this even more than his courtesy, and his food and wine had won Sam's respect and quieted his suspicions. "No, indeed, Master Samwise," said Faramir, "for I'm not learned in elven lore. But there you touch upon another point in which we have changed, declining from Numenor to Middle-earth. For as you may know, if Mithrandir was your companion and you have spoken with Elrond, the Edain, the fathers of the Numenoreans, fought beside the elves in the first wars, and were awarded by the gift of the kingdom in the midst of the sea, within sight of Elvenhome. But in Middle-earth men and elves became estranged in the days of darkness, by the arts of the enemy, and by the slow changes of time in which each kind walked further down their sundered roads. Men now fear and misdoubt the elves, and yet know little of them. And we of Gondor grow like other men, like the men of Rohan, for even they, who are the foes of the Dark Lord, shun the elves and speak of the Golden Wood with dread. Yet there are among us still some who have dealings with the elves when they may, and ever and anon one will go in secret to Lorien, seldom to return. Not I. For I deem it perilous now for mortal man wilfully to seek out the elder people. Yet I envy you that have spoken with the White Lady." "The Lady of Lorien, Galadriel?" cried Sam. "You should see her. Indeed you should, sir. I'm only a hobbit, and gardening's my job at home, sir, if you understand me, and I'm not much good at poetry, not at making it. A bit of a comic rhyme, perhaps, now and again, you know, but not real poetry, so I can't tell you what I mean. It ought to be sung. You'd have to get Strider, Aragorn, that is, or old Mr. Bilbo for that. But I wish I could make a song about her. Beautiful she is, sir. Lovely. Sometimes like a great tree in flower, sometimes like a white daffodowndilly, small and slender-like. Hard as diamonds, soft as moonlight, warm as sunlight, cold as frost in the stars, proud and far off as a snow mountain, and as merry as any lass I ever saw with daisies in her hair in springtime. But that's a lot of nonsense, and all wide of my mark." "Then she must be lovely indeed," said Faramir, "perilously fair." "I don't know about perilous," said Sam. "It strikes me that folk takes their peril with them into Lorien, and finds it there because they brought it. But perhaps you could call her perilous, because she's so strong in herself. You could dash yourself to pieces on her, like a ship on a rock, or drown yourself, like a hobbit in a river. But neither rock nor river would be to blame. Now, borrow—" He stopped and went red in the face. "Yes? Now, Boromir, you would say?" said Faramir. "What would you say? He took his peril with him?" "Yes, sir,"
begging your pardon, and a fine man as your brother was, if I may say so. But you've been warm on the scent all along. Now, I watched Boromir and listened to him, from Rivendell all down the road, looking after my master, as you'll understand, and not meaning any harm to Boromir, and it's my opinion that in Lorien he first saw clearly what I guessed sooner, what he wanted. From the moment he first saw it, he wanted the enemy's ring.
Sam! Cried Frodo aghast.
He'd fallen deep into his own thoughts for a while, and came out of them suddenly and too late.
Save me! Said Sam, turning white, and then flushing scarlet. There I go again. Whenever you open your big mouth and put your foot in it, the gaffer used to say to me, and right enough, oh dear, oh dear. Now, look here, sir. He turned, facing up to Faramir with all the courage that he could muster. Don't you go taking advantage of my master because his servant's no better than a fool. You've spoken very handsome all along, put me off my guard, talking of elves and all, but handsome is as handsome does, we say. Now's a chance to show your quality.
So it seems, said Faramir slowly and very softly, with a strange smile. So that is the answer to all the riddles. The one ring that was thought to have perished from the world, and Boromir tried to take it by force, and you escaped, and ran all the way to me. And here in the wild I have you, two halflings, and a host of men at my call, and the Ring of Rings. A pretty stroke of fortune, a chance for Faramir, captain of Gondor, to show his quality. Ah! He stood up very tall and stern, his grey eyes glinting. Frodo and Sam sprang from their stools and set themselves side by side with their backs to the wall, fumbling for their sword-hilts. There was a silence. All the men in the cave stopped talking and looked towards them in wonder. But Faramir sat down again in his chair and began to laugh quietly, and then suddenly became grave again. "Alas for Boromir! It was too sore a trial," he said. "How you have increased my sorrow, you two strange wanderers from a far country, bearing the peril of men. But you are less judges of men than I of halflings. We are truth-speakers, we men of Gondor. We boast seldom, and then perform, or die in the attempt. Not if I found it on the highway would I take it," I said. "Even if I were such a man as to desire this thing, and even though I knew not clearly what this thing was when I spoke, still I should take those words as a vow, and be held by them. But I am not such a man, or I am wise enough to know that there are some perils from which a man must flee. Sit at peace, and be comforted, Samwise. If you seem to have stumbled, think that it was fated to be so. Your heart is shrewd as well as faithful, and saw clearer than your eyes. For strange though it may seem, it was safe to declare this to me. It may even help the master that you love. It shall turn to his good, if it is in my power, so be comforted. But do not even name this thing again aloud. Once is enough." The hobbits came back to their seats and sat very quiet. Men turned back to their drink and their talk, perceiving that their captain had had some jest or other with the little guests, and that it was over. "Well, Frodo, now at last we understand one another," said Faramir. "If you took this thing on yourself, unwilling, at others asking, then you have pity and honour from me, and I marvel at you, to keep it hid and not to use it. You are a new people and a new world to me. Are all your kin of like sort? Your land must be a realm of peace and content, and there must gardeners be in high honour." "Not all is well there," said Frodo, "but certainly gardeners are honoured. But folk must grow weary there, even in their gardens, as do all things under the sun of this world, and you are far from home and wayworn. No more to-night. Sleep, both of you, in peace, if you can. Fear not. I don't wish to see it, or touch it, or know more of it than I know, which is enough, lest peril perchance waylay me, and I fall lower in the test than Frodo, son of Drogo. Go now to rest. But first, tell me only,
if you will, whither you wish to go and what to do, for I must watch and wait and think. Time passes. In the morning we must each go swiftly on the ways appointed to us. Frodo had felt himself trembling as the first shock of fear passed. Now a great weariness came down on him like a cloud. He could dissemble and resist no longer. "I was going to find a way into Mordor," he said faintly. "I was going to Gorgoroth. I must find the Mountain of Fire and cast the thing into the Gulf of Doom. Gandalf said so. I don't think I shall ever get there." Faramir stared at him for a moment in grave astonishment. Then suddenly he caught him as he swayed, and lifting him gently, carried him to the bed and laid him there, and covered him warmly. At once he fell into a deep sleep. Another bed was set beside him for his servant. Sam hesitated for a moment, then bowing very low, "Good night, Captain, my lord," he said. "You took the chance, sir." "Did I so?" said Faramir. "Yes, sir, and showed your quality, the very highest." Faramir smiled. "A pert servant, Master Samwise. But nay, the praise of the praiseworthy is above all rewards. Yet there was naught in this to praise. I had no lure or desire to do other than I have done."
"Ah, well, sir," said Sam, "you said my master had an elvish air, and that was good and true. But I can say this. You have an air, too, sir, that reminds me of Gandalf, of wizards."
"Maybe," said Faramir, "maybe you discern from far away the air of Numenor. Good night."
Chapter 6 The Forbidden Pool. Frodo woke to find Faramir bending over him. For a second old fear seized him, and he sat up and shrank away.
"There is nothing to fear," said Faramir.
"Is it morning already?" said Frodo, yawning.
"Not yet, but night is drawing to an end, and the full moon is setting. Will you come and see it? Also, there is a matter on which I desire your counsel. I'm sorry to rouse you from sleep, but will you come?"
"I will," said Frodo, rising and shivering a little, as he left the warm blanket and pelts. It seemed cold in the fireless cave. The noise of the water was loud in the stillness. He put on his cloak and followed Faramir. Sam, waking suddenly by some instinct of watchfulness, saw first his master's empty bed and leapt to his feet. Then he saw two dark figures, Frodo and a man, framed against the archway, which was now filled with a pale white light. He hurried after them, past rows of men sleeping on mattresses along the wall. As he went by the cave mouth, he saw that the curtain was now become a dazzling veil of silk and pearls and silver thread, melting icicles of moonlight. But he did not pause to admire it, and turning aside he followed his master through the narrow doorway in the wall of the cave. They went first along a black passage, then up many wet steps, and so came to a small flat landing cut in the stone and lit by the pale sky, gleaming high above through a long deep shaft. From here two flights of steps led, one going on, as it seemed, up on to the high bank of the stream, the other turning away to the left. This they followed. It wound its way up like a turret stair. At last they came out of the stony darkness and looked about. They were on a wide, flat rock without rail or parapet. At their right, eastwards, the torrent fell, splashing over many terraces, and then, pouring down a steep race, it filled a smooth-hewn channel with a dark force of water flecked with foam, and curling and rushing almost at their feet, it plunged sheer over the edge that yawned upon their left. A man stood there, near the brink, silent, gazing down. Frodo turned to watch the sleek necks of the water as they curved and dived. Then he lifted his eyes and gazed far away. The world was quiet and cold, as if dawn were near.
Far off in the west, the full moon was sinking, round and white. Pale mists shimmered in the great vale below, a wide gulf of silver fume, beneath which rolled the cool night waters of the Anduin. A black darkness loomed beyond, and in it glinted, here and there, cold, sharp, remote, white as the teeth of ghosts, the peaks of Ered Nimraeus, the white mountains of the realm of Gondor, tipped with everlasting snow. For a while Frodo stood there on the high stone, and a shiver ran through him, wondering if anywhere in the vastness of the Nightlands his old companions walked or slept, or lay dead shrouded in mist. Why was he brought here out of forgetful sleep? Sam was eager for an answer to the same question, and could not refrain himself from muttering, for his master's ear alone, as he thought, "It's a fine view, no doubt, Mr. Frodo, but chilly to the heart, not to mention the bones. What's going on?" Faramir heard and answered, "Moon set over Gondor. Fair Ithil, as it goes from Middle-earth, glances upon the white locks of old Mindolwin. It is worth a few shivers, but that is not what I brought you to see, though as for you, Samwise, you were not brought, and do but pay the penalty of your watchfulness. A draught of wine shall amend it. Come, look now." He stepped up beside the silent sentinel on the dark edge, and Frodo followed. Sam hung back. He already felt insecure enough on this high, wet platform. Faramir and Frodo looked down. Far below them they saw the white waters pour into a foaming bowl, and then swirl darkly about a deep oval basin in the rocks, until they found their way out again through a narrow gate, and flowed away, fuming and chattering, into calmer and more level reaches. The moonlight still slanted down to the fall's foot, and gleamed on the ripples of the basin. Presently Frodo was aware of a small, dark thing on the near bank, but even as he looked at it, it dived and vanished just beyond the boil and bubble of the fall, cleaving the black water as neatly as an arrow or an edgewise stone. Faramir turned to the man at his side. "Now what would you say that is, Unborn? A squirrel or a kingfisher? Are there black kingfishers in the night pools of Mirkwood?"
"'Tis not a bird, whatever else it be," answered Unborn. "It has four limbs and dives manwise. A pretty mastery of the craft it shows, too. What is it at? Seeking a way up behind the curtain to our hidings? It seems we're discovered at last. I have my bow here, and I have posted other archers, nigh as good marksmen as myself, on either bank. We wait only for your command to shoot, Captain."
"Shall we shoot?" said Faramir, turning quickly to Frodo. Frodo didn't answer for a moment, then, "No," he said, "no, I beg you not to." If Sam had dared, he would have said, "Yes," quick and loud. He couldn't see, but he guessed well enough from their words what they were looking at.
"You know, then, what this thing is?" said Faramir. "Come now, you have seen. Tell me why it should be spared. In all our words together you have not once spoken of your gangrel companion, and I let him be for the time. He could wait till he was caught and brought before us. I sent my keenest huntsman to seek him, but he slipped them, and they had no sight of him till now, save Unborn here, once at dusk yesterday evening. But now he's done worse trespass than only to go coney-snaring in the uplands. He has dared to come to Henneth Annwn, and his life is forfeit. I marvel at the creature, so secret and so sly as he is, to come sporting in the pool before our very window. Does he think that men sleep without watch all night? Why does he so?"
"There are two answers, I think," said Frodo. "For one thing, he knows little of men, and sly though he is, your refuge is so hidden that perhaps he does not know that men are concealed here. For another, I think he is allured here by a mastering desire stronger than his caution." "He is lured here, then, you say?" said Faramir in a low voice. "Can he, does he then know of your burden?" "Indeed, yes. He bore it himself for many years."
"He bore it?" said Faramir, breathing sharply in his wonder.
This matter winds itself ever in new riddles. Then he is pursuing it? Maybe. It is precious to him. But I did not speak of that. What then does the creature seek?
Fish, said Frodo. Look.
They peered down at the dark pool. A little black head appeared at the far end of the basin, just out of the deep shadow of the rocks. There was a brief silver glint, and a swirl of tiny ripples. It swam to the side, and then with marvellous agility a frog-like figure climbed out of the water and up the bank. At once it sat down and began to gnaw at the small silver thing that glittered as it turned. The last rays of the moon were now falling behind the stony wall at the pool's end. Faramir laughed softly.
Fish, he said. It is a less perilous hunger. Or maybe not. Fish from the pool of Henneth Arnoun may cost him all he has to give.
Now I have him at the arrow point, said Unborn. Shall I not shoot, Captain, for coming unbidden to this place? Death is our law.
Wait, Unborn, said Faramir. This is a harder matter than it seems. What have you to say now, Frodo? Why should we spare?
The creature is wretched and hungry, said Frodo, and unaware of his danger.
And Gandalf, your Mithrandir, he would have bidden you not to slay him for that reason, and for others. He forbade the elves to do so. I don't know clearly why, and of what I guess I cannot speak openly out here. But this creature is in some way bound up with my errand. Until you found us and took us, he was my guide.
Your guide, said Faramir. The matter becomes ever stranger. I would do much for you, Frodo, but this I cannot grant.
To let this sly wanderer go free, at his own will from here, to join you later if it please him, or to be caught by orcs and tell all he knows under threat of pain. He must be slain or taken. Slain, if he be not taken very swiftly. But how can this slippery thing of many guises be caught, save by a feathered shaft?
Let me go down quietly to him, said Frodo. You may keep your bows bent, and shoot me at least if I fail. I shan't run away.
Go then and be swift, said Faramir. If he comes off alive, he should be your faithful servant for the rest of his unhappy days. Lead Frodo down to the bank, Unborn, and go softly. The thing has a nose and ears. Give me your bow.
Unborn grunted and led the way down the winding stair to the landing, and then up the other stair, until at last they came to a narrow opening shrouded with thick bushes. Passing silently through, Frodo found himself on the top of the southern bank above the pool. It was now dark, and the falls were pale and grey, reflecting only the lingering moonlight of the western sky. He couldn't see Gollum. He went forward a short way, and Unborn came softly behind him.
"Go on," he breathed in Frodo's ear. "Have a care to your right. If you fall in the pool, then no one but your fishing friend can help you. And forget not that there are bowmen near at hand, though you may not see them."
Frodo crept forward, using his hands, Gollum-like, to feel his way and to steady himself. The rocks were for the most part flat and smooth, but slippery. He halted, listening. At first he could hear no sound but the unceasing rush of the fall behind him. Then presently he heard, not far ahead, a hissing murmur.
"Fish! Nice fish! White face has vanished, my precious, at last, yes. Now we can eat fish in peace. No, not in peace, precious, for precious is last year's lost. Dirty hobbits, nasty hobbits, gone and left us, Gollum, and precious is gone. Only poor Smeagol all alone. No, precious, nasty men, they'll take it, steal my precious. Thieves, we hates them. Fish, nice fish, makes us strong, makes eyes bright, fingers tight, yes. Throttle them, precious, throttle them all, yes, if we get chances. Nice fish, nice fish."
So it went on,
almost as unceasing as the waterfall, only interrupted by a faint noise of slavering and gurgling. Frodo shivered, listening with pity and disgust. He wished it would stop, and that he never need hear that voice again. Anborn was not far behind. He could creep back and ask him to get the huntsman to shoot. They would probably get close enough while Gollum was gorging and off his guard. Only one true shot, and Frodo would be rid of the miserable voice forever. But no. Gollum had a claim on him now. The servant has a claim on the master for service, even service in fear. They would have found it in the dead marshes but for Gollum. Frodo knew, too, somehow quite clearly, that Gandalf would not have wished it. "Smeagol," he said softly.
"Fish. Nice fish," said the voice.
"Smeagol," he said a little louder. The voice stopped. "Smeagol, master has come to look for you. Master is here. Come, Smeagol." There was no answer but a soft hiss, as of intaken breath. "Come, Smeagol," said Frodo. "We're in danger. Men will kill you. If they find you here, come quickly, if you wish to escape death. Come to master."
"No," said the voice. "Not nice master. Leaves poor Smeagol and goes with new friends. Master can wait. Smeagol hasn't finished."
"There's no time," said Frodo. "Bring fish with you. Come."
"No, must finish fish."
"Smeagol," said Frodo desperately. "Precious will be angry. I shall take Precious, and I shall say, 'Make him swallow the bones and choke. Never taste fish again. Come, Precious is waiting.'" There was a sharp hiss. Presently, out of the darkness, Gollum came crawling on all fours, like an erring dog called to heel. He had a half-eaten fish in his mouth and another in his hand. He came close to Frodo, almost nose to nose, and sniffed at him. His pale eyes were shining. Then he took the fish out of his mouth and stood up.
"Nice master," he whispered. "Nice hobbit. Come back to poor Smeagol. Good Smeagol comes. Now let's go. Go quickly, yes, through the trees, while the faces are dark. Yes, come, let's go."
"Yes, we'll go soon," said Frodo, "but not at once. I will go with you as I promised. I promise again, but not now. You are not safe yet. I will save you, but you must trust me."
"We must trust master," said Gollum doubtfully. "Why? Why not go at once? Where is the other one, the cross, rude hobbit? Where is he?"
"Away up there," said Frodo, pointing to the waterfall. "I'm not going without him. We must go back to him." His heart sank. This was too much like trickery. He didn't really fear that Faramir would allow Gollum to be killed, and he would probably make him prisoner and bind him. And certainly what Frodo did would seem a treachery to the poor, treacherous creature. It would probably be impossible ever to make him understand or believe that Frodo had saved his life in the only way he could. What else could he do? To keep faith, as near as might be, with both sides. "Come," he said, "or the Precious will be angry. We are going back now, up the stream. Go on, go on, you go in front." Gollum crawled along close to the bank for a little way, snuffling and suspicious. Presently he stopped and raised his head.
"Something's there," he said. "Not a hobbit."
Suddenly he turned back. A green light was flickering in his bulging eyes.
"Master, master," he hissed. "Wicked, tricksy, false."
He spat and stretched out his long arms with white snapping fingers. At that moment the great black shape of Unborn loomed up behind him and came down on him. A large strong hand took him in the nape of the neck and pinned him. He twisted round like lightning, all wet and slimy as he was, wriggling like an eel, biting and scratching like a cat. But two more men came up out of the shadows.
"Hold still," said one, "or we'll stick you as full of pins as a hedgehog. Hold still."
Gollum went limp and began to whine and weep. They tied him, none too gently. "Easy, easy," said Frodo. "He has no strength to match you. Don't hurt him if you can help it. "'He'll be quieter if you don't. "'Smeagol, they won't hurt you. "'I'll go with you, and you shall come to no harm. "'Not unless they kill me too. "'Trust master.' "'Gollum turned and spat at him. "'The men picked him up, put a hood over his eyes, and carried him off. "'Frodo followed them, feeling very wretched. "'They went through the opening behind the bushes and back, "'down the stairs and passages into the cave. "'Two or three torches had been lit.' Men were stirring. Sam was there, and he gave a queer look at the limp bundle that the men carried. "'Got him?' he said to Frodo. "'Yes. Well, no, I didn't get him. He came to me, because he trusted me at first, I'm afraid. I didn't want him tied up like this. I hope it will be all right, but I hate the whole business.'
"'So do I,' said Sam. "'And nothing will ever be all right where that piece of misery is.'
A man came and beckoned to the hobbits, and took them to the recess at the back of the cave. Faramir was sitting there in his chair, and the lamp had been rekindled in its niche above his head. He signed to them to sit down on the stools beside him. "'Bring wine for the guests,' he said, "'and bring the prisoner to me.' The wine was brought, and then Unborn came carrying Gollum. He had removed the cover from Gollum's head, and set him on his feet, standing behind him to support him. Gollum blinked, hooding the malice of his eyes with their heavy, pale lids. A very miserable creature he looked, dripping and dank, smelling of fish. He still clutched one in his hand. His sparse locks were hanging like rank weed over his bony brows. His nose was snivelling.
"'Lucius! Lucius!' he said. "'The cord hurts us. Yes, it does. It hurts us. And we've done nothing.'
"'Nothing?' said Faramir, looking at the wretched creature with a keen glance, but without any expression in his face either of anger or pity or wonder. "'Nothing? Have you never done anything worthy of binding or of worse punishment? However, that is not for me to judge, happily. But tonight you have come where it is death to come.' The fish of this pool are dearly bought. Gollum dropped the fish from his hand.
"'Don't want fish,' he said.
"'The price is not set on the fish,' said Faramir. "'Only to come here and look on the pool bears the penalty of death. I've spared you so far at the prayer of Frodo here, who says that of him, at least, you have deserved some thanks. But you must also satisfy me. What is your name? Whence do you come?' "'And whither do you go? What is your business?'
"'We are lost, lost,' said Gollum. "'No name, no business, no precious, nothing, only empty, only hungry. Yes, we are hungry. A few little fishes, nasty, bony little fishes for a poor creature, and they say death. So wise they are, so just, so very just.'
"'Not very wise,' said Faramir, "'but just. "'Yes, perhaps, as just as our little wisdom allows. "'Unloose him, Frodo.' "'Faramir took a small nail-knife from his belt and handed it to Frodo. "'Gollum, misunderstanding the gesture, squealed and fell down. "'Now, Smeagol,' said Frodo, "'you must trust me. "'I will not desert you. "'Answer truthfully, if you can. "'It will do you good, not harm.' He cut the cords on Gollum's wrists and ankles and raised him to his feet. "'Come hither,' said Faramir. "'Look at me. Do you know the name of this place? Have you been here before?' Slowly Gollum raised his eyes and looked unwillingly into Faramir's. All light went out of them, and they stared bleak and pale for a moment into the clear, unwavering eyes of the man of Gondor. There was a still silence. Then Gollum dropped his head and shrank down. "'Until he was squatting on the floor, shivering.
"'We doesn't know, and we doesn't want to know,' he whimpered. "'Never came here, never come again.'
"'There are locked doors and closed windows in your mind, "'and dark rooms behind them,' said Faramir. "'But in this I judge that you speak the truth. "'It is well for you. "'What oath will you swear never to return, "'and never to lead any living creature hither by word or sign?'
"'Master knows,' said Gollum with a sidelong glance at Frodo.
"'Yes, he knows. We will promise master, if he saves us. We'll promise to eat.'
"'Yes.' He crawled to Frodo's feet.
"'Save us, nice master,' he whined. "'Smeagol promises to precious, promises faithfully. Never come again, never speak, no, never, no, precious, no.'
"'Are you satisfied?' said Faramir. "'Yes,' said Frodo. "'At least you must either accept this promise or carry out your law. You'll get no more, but I promised that if he came to me, he should not be harmed, and I would not be proved faithless.' Faramir sat for a moment in thought. "'Very good,' he said at last. "'I surrender you to your master, to Frodo, son of Drogo.' Let him declare what he will do with you.
But, Lord Faramir, said Frodo, bowing, you have not yet declared your will concerning the said Frodo, and until that is made known, he cannot shape his plans for himself or his companions. Your judgment was postponed until the morning, but that is now at hand.
Then I will declare my doom, said Faramir. As for you, Frodo, in so far as lies in me under higher authority, I declare you free in the realm of Gondor, to the furthest of its ancient bounds, save only that neither you, nor any that go with you, have leave to come to this place unbidden. This dome shall stand for a year and a day, and then cease, unless you shall before the term come to Minas Tirith, and present yourself to the lord and steward of the city. Then I will entreat him to confirm what I have done, and to make it lifelong. In the meantime, whomsoever you take under your protection shall be under my protection and under the shield of Gondor. Are you answered?
Frodo bowed low. I am answered, he said, and I place myself at your service, if that is of any worth to one so high and honourable.
It is of great worth, said Faramir. And now, do you take this creature, this Smeagol, under your protection?
I do take Smeagol under my protection, said Frodo.
Sam sighed audibly, and not at the courtesies, of which, as any hobbit would, he thoroughly approved. Indeed, in the Shire, such a matter would have required a great many more words and bows.
"'Then I say to you,' said Faramir, turning to Gollum, "'you are under doom of death, but while you walk with Frodo you are safe for our part. Yet if ever you be found by any man of Gondor astray without him—' The doom shall fall, and may death find you swiftly, within Gondor or without, if you do not well serve him. Now answer me. Whither would you go? You are his guide, he says. Whither are you leading him?
Gollum made no reply.
This I will not have secret, said Faramir. Answer me, or I will reverse my judgment.
Still Gollum did not answer. I will answer for him, said Frodo. He brought me to the Black Gate, as I asked, but it was impassable.
"'There is no open gate into the Nameless Land,' said Faramir.
"'Seeing this, we turned aside and came by the southward road,' Frodo continued, "'for he said that there is, or there may be, a path near to Minas Ithil.'
"'Minas Morgul,' said Faramir.
"'I don't know clearly,' said Frodo, "'but the path climbs, I think.' "'up into the mountains on the northern side of that vale, "'where the old city stands. "'It goes up to a high cliff, and so down to that which is beyond.
"'Do you know the name of that high pass?' said Faramir.
"'No,' said Frodo.
"'It is called Cirith Ungol.'
"'Gollum hissed sharply, and began muttering to himself.
"'Is not that its name?' said Faramir, turning to him.
"'No,' said Gollum. And then he squealed, as if something had stabbed him. "'Yes, yes, we heard the name once. But what does the name matter to us? Master says he must get in, so we must try some way. There is no other way to try. No.'
"'No other way?' said Faramir. "'How do you know that? And who has explored all the confines of that dark realm?' He looked long and thoughtfully at Gollum. Presently he spoke again. "'Take this creature away, unborn. Treat him gently, but watch him. "'And do not you, Smeagol, try to dive into the falls.
The rocks have such teeth there as would slay you before your time. Leave us now and take your fish." Arnborn went out, and Gollum went cringing before him. The curtain was drawn across the recess. "Frodo, I think you do very unwisely in this," said Faramir. "I don't think you should go with this creature. It's wicked." "No, not altogether wicked," said Frodo. "Not wholly, perhaps," said Faramir. "But malice eats it like a canker, and the evil is growing. He'll lead you to no good. If you will part with him, I'll give him safe conduct and guidance to any point on the borders of Gondor that he may name." "He wouldn't take it," said Frodo. "He'd follow after me as he long has done, and I've promised many times to take him under my protection and to go where he led. You wouldn't ask me to break faith with him?"
"No," said Faramir, "but my heart would, for it seems less evil to counsel another man to break troth than to do so oneself, especially if one sees a friend bound unwitting to his own harm. But no, if he'll go with you, you must now endure him. But I don't think you are holden to go to Cirith Ungol, of which he has told you less than he knows. That much I perceived clearly in his mind. Don't go to Cirith Ungol."
"Where then shall I go?" said Frodo. "Back to the Black Gate and deliver myself up to the guard? What do you know against this place that makes its name so dreadful?"
"Nothing certain," said Faramir. "We of Gondor do not ever pass east of the road in these days, and none of us younger men has ever done so, nor has any of us set foot upon the Mountains of Shadow. Of them we know only old report and the rumour of bygone days. But there is some dark terror that dwells in the passes above Minas Morgul. If Cirith Ungol is named, old men and masters of law will blanch and fall silent." "The valley of Minas Morgul passed into evil very long ago, and it was a menace and a dread while the banished enemy dwelt yet far away, and Ithilien was still for the most part in our keeping. As you know, that city was once a strong place, proud and fair, Minas Ithil, the twin sister of our own city. But it was taken by fell men whom the enemy in his first strength had dominated, and who wandered homeless and masterless after his fall. It is said that their lords were men of Numenor, who had fallen into dark wickedness. To them the enemy had given rings of power, and he had devoured them. Living ghosts they were become, terrible and evil. After his going they took Minas Ithil and dwelt there, and they filled it, and all the valley about, with decay. It seemed empty, and was not so, for a shapeless fear lived within the ruined walls. 9 lords there were, and after the return of their master, which they aided and prepared in secret, they grew strong again. Then the 9 riders issued forth from the gates of horror, and we could not withstand them. Do not approach their citadel. You will be espied. It is a place of sleepless malice, full of lidless eyes. Do not go that way."
"But where else will you direct me?" said Frodo. "You can't yourself, you say, guide me to the mountains, nor over them. But over the mountains I'm bound, by solemn undertaking to the council, to find a way or perish in the seeking. And if I turn back, refusing the road in its bitter end, where then shall I go among elves or men? Would you have me come to Gondor with this thing, the thing that drove your brother mad with desire? What spell would it work in Minas Tirith? Shall there be 2 cities of Minas Morgul, grinning at each other across a dead land filled with rottenness?"
"I would not have it so," said Faramir.
"Then what would you have me do?"
"I know not. Only I would not have you go to death or to torment. And I don't think that Mithrandir would have chosen this way.
Yet since he's gone, I must take such paths as I can find, and there is no time for long searching," said Frodo.
"It's a hard doom and a hopeless errand," said Faramir. "But at the least, remember my warning. Beware of this guide, Smeagol. He's done murder before now. I read it in him." He sighed. "Well, so we meet and part, Frodo, son of Drogo. You have no need of soft words. I don't hope to see you again on any other day under this sun.
but you shall go now with my blessing upon you, and upon all your people. Rest a little while food is prepared for you. I would gladly learn how this creeping Smeagol became possessed of the thing of which we speak, and how he lost it, but I will not trouble you now. If ever beyond hope you return to the lands of the living, and we retell our tales, sitting by a wall in the sun, laughing at old grief, you shall tell me then. Until that time, or some other time beyond the vision of the seeing stones of Numenor, farewell. He rose and bowed low to Frodo, and drawing the curtain, passed out into the cave. Chapter 7 Journey to the Crossroads. Frodo and Sam returned to their beds, and lay there in silence, resting for a little, while men bestirred themselves, and the business of the day began. After a while water was brought to them, and then they were led to a table where food was set for three. Faramir broke his fast with them. He had not slept since the battle on the day before, yet he didn't look weary. When they'd finished, they stood up. "May no hunger trouble you on the road," said Faramir. "You have little provision, but some small store of food fit for travellers I have ordered to bestow in your packs. You will have no lack of water as you walk in Ithilien, but don't drink of any stream that flows from Imlad Morgul, the Valley of Living Death. This also I must tell you. My scouts and watchers have all returned, even some that have crept within sight of the Morannon. They all find a strange thing. The land is empty. Nothing is on the road, and no sound of foot or horn or bowstring is anywhere to be heard. A waiting silence broods above the nameless land. I don't know what this portends, but the time draws swiftly to some great conclusion. Storm is coming. Hasten while you may. If you are ready, let us go. The sun will soon rise above the shadow." The hobbits' packs were brought to them, a little heavier than they had been, and also two stout staves of polished wood, shod with iron, and with carven heads through which ran plaited leathern thongs. "I have no fitting gifts to give you at our parting," said Faramir, "but take these staves. They may be of service to those who walk or climb in the wild. The men of the White Mountains use them, though these have been cut down to your height and newly shod. They are made of the fair tree Lebethron, beloved of the woodwrights of Gondor, and a virtue has been set upon them of finding and returning. May that virtue not wholly fail under the shadow into which you go." The hobbits bowed low. "Most gracious host," said Frodo, "it was said to me by Elrond Half-Elven that I should find friendship upon the way, secret and unlooked for. Certainly I looked for no such friendship as you have shown. To have found it turns evil to great good." Chapter 8 The Stairs of Cirith Ungol. Gollum was tugging at Frodo's cloak and hissing with fear and impatience.
"We must go," he said. "We mustn't stand here. Make haste."
Reluctantly Frodo turned his back on the west and followed as his guide led him, out into the darkness of the east. They left the ring of trees and crept along the road towards the mountains. This road, too, ran straight for a while, but soon it began to bend away southwards until it came right under the great shoulder of rock that they had seen from the distance. Black and forbidding it loomed above them, darker than the dark sky behind. Crawling under its shadow the road went on, and rounding it sprang east again and began to climb steeply. Frodo and Sam were plodding along with heavy hearts, no longer able to care greatly about their peril. Frodo's head was bowed. His burden was dragging him down again. As soon as the great crossroads had been passed, the weight of it, almost forgotten in Ithilien, had begun to grow once more. Now, feeling the way become steep before his feet, he looked wearily up, and then he saw it, even as Gollum had said that he would. The city of the Ringwraiths. He cowered against the stony bank.
A long tilted valley, a deep gulf of shadow, ran back far into the mountains. Upon the further side, some way within the valley's arms, high on a rocky seat upon the black knees of the Ethelduath, stood the walls and tower of Minas Morgul. All was dark about it, earth and sky, but it was lit with light. Not the imprisoned moonlight welling through the marbled walls of Minas Ithil long ago, tower of the moon, fair and radiant in the hollow of the hills. Paler indeed than the moon, ailing in some slow eclipse, was the light of it now, wavering and blowing like a noisome exhalation of decay, a corpse light, a light that illuminated nothing. In the walls and tower windows showed, like countless black holes looking inward into emptiness. But the topmost course of the tower revolved slowly, first one way and then another, a huge ghostly head leering into the night. For a moment the three companions stood there, shrinking, staring up with unwilling eyes. Gollum was the first to recover. Again he pulled at their cloaks urgently, but he spoke no word. Almost he dragged them forward. Every step was reluctant, and time seemed to slow its pace, so that between the raising of a foot and the setting of it down, minutes of loathing passed. So they came slowly to the white bridge. Here the road, gleaming faintly, passed over the stream in the midst of the valley, and went on, winding deviously up towards the city's gate, a black mouth opening in the outer circle of the northward walls. Wide flats lay on either bank, shadowy meads filled with pale white flowers. Luminous these were too, beautiful and yet horrible of shape, like the demented forms in an uneasy dream, and they gave forth a faint sickening charnel smell. An odour of rottenness filled the air. From mead to mead the bridge sprang. Figures stood there at its head, carven with cunning in forms human and bestial, but all corrupt and loathsome. The water flowing beneath was silent, and it steamed, but the vapour that rose from it, curling and twisting about the bridge, was deadly cold. Frodo felt his senses reeling and his mind darkening. Then suddenly, as if some force were at work other than his own will, he began to hurry, tottering forward, his groping hands held out, his head lolling from side to side. Both Sam and Gollum ran after him. Sam caught his master in his arms, as he stumbled and almost fell, right on the threshold of the bridge.
"Not that way, not that way," whispered Gollum,
but the breath between his teeth seemed to tear the heavy stillness like a whistle, and he cowered to the ground in terror.
"Hold up, Mr. Frodo," muttered Sam in Frodo's ear. "Come back, not that way. Gollum says not, and for once I agree with him."
Frodo passed his hand over his brow and wrenched his eyes away from the city on the hill. The luminous tower fascinated him, and he fought the desire that was on him to run up the gleaming road towards its gate. At last, with an effort, he turned back, and as he did so, he felt the ring resisting him, dragging at the chain about his neck, and his eyes, too, as he looked away, seemed for the moment to have been blinded. The darkness before him was impenetrable. Gollum, crawling on the ground like a frightened animal, was already vanishing into the gloom. Sam, supporting and guiding his stumbling master, followed after him as quickly as he could. Not far from the near bank of the stream there was a gap in the stone wall beside the road. Through this they passed, and Sam saw that they were on a narrow path that gleamed faintly at first, as the main road did, until climbing above the meads of deadly flowers, it faded and went dark, winding its crooked way up into the northern sides of the valley. Along this path the hobbits trudged, side by side, unable to see Gollum in front of them, except when he turned back to beckon them on. Then his eyes shone with a green-white light, reflecting the noisome Morgul sheen, perhaps, or kindled by some answering mood within. Of that deadly gleam, and of the dark eye-holes, Frodo and Sam were always conscious, ever glancing fearfully over their shoulders,
and ever dragging their eyes back to find the darkening path. Slowly they laboured on. As they rose above the stench and vapours of the poisonous stream, their breath became easier and their heads clearer. But now their limbs